Welcome back to Flat Chat. We've managed to miss a month. Sorry about that. How dare Christmas happen? I'm Stuart Codling. Joining me in the studio here in sunny Richmond is Ben Anderson, the editor of F1 Racing Magazine.
Hello, Codders.
Down the line from Australia, it's a very big g'day sport, or is it good evening sport? Hello, Cobber, to Mark Gallagher.
Good evening.
How is it down there? Is it all still on fire, or is it smouldering now? Has the rain dampened it?
I took a drive down through the Adelaide Hills on Sunday, and I have to say the devastation is pretty extraordinary down and around there. But the fires in South Australia are pretty well all over, thanks to all the hard work of the fire services down here. But they continue in other parts of the country, and I think most people expect us to have some kind of fires in Australia until around about March time. But it's a lot better than it was just 2 or 3 weeks ago.
It used to be that February was bushfire season in Australia, but now pretty much most of the summer is.
Yeah, I mean, the fires this year actually started before the end of October, and when I came down at Christmas time, my extended family down here were telling me that really it's unprecedented to see the fires start this early and to be as severe as they have been. But in the midst of all the news down here about fires, one thing I have picked up on is that about 30 minutes drive from me, Valtteri Bottas has spent at least two separate trips during the winter down here. In fact, he's been down here this week while we were recording the podcast, doing a bit of cycling, which coincides with the Tour Down Under, the big cycle race here in Adelaide. And so he's, Valtteri is obviously famous, but I think he gets away with a bit of anonymity down here in South Australia. And he's been using the cycle race fascination around here to do a bit of extended training.
That's not bad. I've not actually been following the Tour Down Under, which is unforgivable on my part. But did I see Richie Porte has unusually not won a stage? Is Richie Porte still active nowadays? Have you been following it?
To be honest, not really my thing, but I really should follow it because actually it went past my house. So I did actually get up early one morning and we made our way down to the high street, and it was actually quite a sight to see the peloton come through at some speed with a kind of rolling police roadblock. So lots of helicopters in the sky. I think I counted five helicopters following the Tour Down Under. And of course, very familiar team colours. The Ineos team, as it's now called, British team, out in front on that particular stage on that day. And lots of interest here in the Adelaide Hills and beyond in the Tour Down Under. It's a huge event, but I'll bring it back to Formula One again and say I met a couple of people while I was watching the Tour Down Under, and they asked me what I did, and then they were bemoaning the loss of Formula One from Adelaide and saying it was one of the greatest disappointments in South Australian sporting history to lose the Grand Prix from Adelaide across to Melbourne. So I think given half the chance, a lot of people here would like to see Formula One back in Adelaide if they could.
Nice little circuit, actually, wasn't it? I think the pit lane entry, there's quite a sharp corner, isn't there? Because I remember
certainly for David Coulthard.
Well, that's exactly that. I went there to cover a sports car race about 20 years ago, and I actually stood at that corner and thought, well, actually, you know, I did think Coulthard was a bit of a wally when he went off there, but actually, it's quite a sharp bend. It's sharper than it looks on telly.
Well, a return to Adelaide is periodically mooted, isn't it? But never quite manages to gain sufficient traction.
And the thing is, there's huge interest down here because just in motorsport generally, the Clipsil 500, Clipsil sponsorship of the 500 is now gone. But what was the Clipsil 500 for so many years and around the Aussie V8s? I mean, you had figures like 400 and 500,000 people over the course of the weekend attending that race. So there's no lack of enthusiasm for motorsport. And Adelaide being, you know, a really big town, or it's more than a small city, it just lapped up Formula One because it enjoyed, you know, having its moment in the sun, whereas Melbourne kind of has everything. But my memories of Adelaide Grand Prix are kind of threefold. One is 1991 here with Jordan, us nearly getting a podium finish in what became, I think, the shortest ever Grand Prix. It was stopped early. We had Alexander Zanardi and Andrea De Cesaris driving for us. But actually, that's not the thing I remember most about that weekend, because I met my wife on the Friday. And I think by the Monday, we decided we were going to get married. So that was quite a weekend.
Almost like a Craig David song.
That's almost Las Vegas worthy, isn't it?
It was. Well, the thing is, I had to go back home, so we had to make a decision. And we decided we'd probably get married. So she did it a year to the day after we met.
The other thing, that's pressure, isn't it, to make the call? I'm off ski, so What's it going to be?
There is actually a reason why she went for it, which was that actually we were having lunch in the Jordan hospitality area, and this chap asked my what became my future wife to pass the tomato ketchup. And she said to me, he looks awfully similar to Michael Hutchins from INXS, to which I then explained we were sharing a table with INXS. So that kind of went down. I went down extremely well. Second reason I remember Adelaide so well is the very, very serious accident to my good friend Mika Häkkinen in 95, which nearly robbed us of Mika completely. And then thirdly, Ayrton Senna's last ever victory. And making up with Alain Prost on the podium at what became the last time we saw Ayrton on the top step. So, yeah, good memories of Adelaide.
Yeah, really interesting photograph from that podium, because Senna actually looks really, really annoyed. You know, you expect someone to have won a race to actually be sort of quite pleased with that fact. But I think he was kind of digesting the fact that Prost was next to him and he wasn't going to be able to race him again.
Complicated guy, Ayrton, and such a vicious rival to people like Prost. I mean, he took no prisoners, as we know. But a complicated guy, and I think, but full of empathy as well when he... He had another side to him, as we know, that kind of complex character that he could be. He could be do extraordinarily negative things on track from time to time, but then off track, you could see a whole other side to him. And so I think whenever I think about Senna, I tend not to think about Imola, 94 and the end of it all. I tend to think about Adelaide, 93, and that final triumph using a customer Ford Cosworth engine in the back of his McLaren.
Speaking of final triumphs, shall we move on to the business of the day? Because
such a neat segue, Colin.
Sometimes I stagger myself with my own genius.
I should do this for a living.
Well, there is a brand new issue of F1 Racing on the shelves today as you listen to us on subscribers' doormats today on the Monday that we're recording this. And it's going to be the last issue of the magazine in its current form, because as of next month, it's going to be called Grand Prix Racing Magazine. So you'll be able to read more about that in Ben's editorial letter at the beginning. The key thing here is that we're not going to start covering things like Formula E. It's going to be the same content, but it's just going to have no official license. And that's the important thing for us. Not licensing the F1 brand name enables us to remain independent of FOM as well as commercially sustainable. And Ben is going to agree and elucidate.
Allow me to elucidate. Well, I do, as you mentioned, God, as in said magazine. We mentioned on a previous edition of Flat Chat towards the end of last year that we were in the process of being sold. At that time, Motorsport Network's strategy was moving away from print products and focusing almost exclusively on digital products. But there was a change of senior management and a change of heart subsequently, and now there's a refocus on print products and an understanding that they underpin the digital success that's possible. So that means F1 Racing is staying here. That doesn't change the commercial realities of print publishing, which, you know, is no secret. It's very challenging, very difficult, especially to the standard and physical quality that we uphold on F1 Racing. And unfortunately, the license fee that we have to pay to Formula One to license the name, the F1 part of the name particularly, just makes that environment even more challenging than it already is by taking this step. Not that we were not editorially independent of FOM before, but we underline that independence. We don't have to pay that fee that challenges our commercial viability. And also it gives us more freedom to expand into the digital space. Previously there were restrictions on doing that. Now they won't apply. So therefore we will more closely align with the wider strategic objectives of our owners. It's exciting opportunity for us. I guess we'll see what's in a name. It allows us to continue publishing the magazine to the same standard that readers and our listeners have come to expect, and hopefully further enhance it as we go forward. So yes, read more about it in this month's F1 Racing.
Yeah, soon to become Grand Prix Racing Magazine. So enough of this housekeeping. Let's have a look at the current issue, the new one. Fernando Alonso on the cover. He hasn't given up on Formula One. He's planning a comeback next year. Our man James Roberts went to visit him at home in Oviedo for an exclusive interview. We were mildly concerned about how this might turn out because, you know, Jimmy said
Fernando's got something to tell us. We better go and listen. And I was reminded of the famous, possibly apocryphal story about Kate Bush and the record company A&R man who was dispatched to her home to find out what the hell she'd been doing for all these years and was she actually going to be recording any music. And she made it known that she was prepared to divulged something to the record company, and an A&R man was duly sent. He was ushered into the house, and Kate Bush showed him into the kitchen, threw open the oven door, pulled out a tray of rock cakes, and says, "Here's what I've been doing."
Did Fernando pull out a tray of rock cakes? Jimmy didn't mention that when he came back from Oviedo.
He did. He did come back with a functioning interview, and there was some quite interesting stuff. Fernando basically thinks age won't be a problem for him because the cars are less demanding than they used to be.
And he's evergreen.
He's evergreen. He'll be, what, 39 then? He thinks the new 18-inch wheels will make things different for everybody, levelling the playing field. Well, what do we think about that, Mark?
Fernando is such box office, isn't he? I mean, so many fans around the world, and you can't blame the guy for wanting to come back and give it another go, especially because of the really torrid time he had in his last few seasons of Formula One. But that figure you just gave, 39, really should tell us, and frankly should tell him, that it would be a mistake to come back, because it's all very well him saying the cars are going to be easier to drive. That's just a sales pitch. He can drive a car, no question about it, and he'll be able to drive a car very quickly. Will he be able to drive a car competitively enough against a 24-year-old Charles Leclerc and Max Verstappen, goodness knows who else will be coming along by that stage, not to mention a Lewis Hamilton who may still well be at it, and I can't see Lewis backing off in terms of his focus on remaining on top of the pile. So what does that mean? You know, what's the point for Fernando to come back? He may have unfinished business, but as we saw with Michael Schumacher's return to Formula One, it can become a pretty salutary experience to step back into these race cars after a time away and discover that, frankly, the whole game has moved on somewhat.
I'm not quite so pessimistic as Mark on the Fernando score. I think you make some valid points, and the Schumacher comparison is interesting. But Fernando tackles that himself in the story. And he says the big problem for Schumacher was coming back after a long period of away and the tyre characteristics fundamentally changing. Formula One in Schumacher's era was mostly a flat-out blast between stints. New tyres going on, tyres designed to be driven flat out all the time, not really much in the way of degradation. And the Formula One he returned to was fundamentally different, not only in terms of aero steps, but in a similar way Robert Kubica found, suddenly you've got these very tricky Pirelli tyres that are high degradation, completely different to what you're used to. It takes a long time to understand them, and he didn't have the practice, if you like. Whereas Alonso's saying, well, it's going to be fundamentally the same. Yes, there's a major rule change. Yes, the size of the wheels is going to change, but it's still going to be Pirelli. It's still going to be the same fundamental things that I'm used to and have mastered. So that won't be a problem. I can come straight back in. I also don't think Fernando has degraded as a driver. I think he chose to step out. He could have carried on with McLaren had he wanted to. Now that relationship's come to an end, he sees an opportunity to come back if the stars align, if the playing field is more level, if he can find the right opportunity. I don't think he'll come back for the sake of it. He'll come back if there's a top drive available. And, you know, we can argue about the rule changes. This is the age-old debate, isn't it? Does a major rule change present an opportunity to close up the field? This is where I think Fernando's wrong. Historically, major rule changes stretch the field out, and it takes rule stability to bring everybody together. So really, he's looking at the same top three teams we see now. They are likely to be the same top three in 2021. The gap to the midfield probably will be bigger until they work out with their lesser resources how to close it, notwithstanding the budget cap. And of course, some of those doors are closing to him. You know, Max Verstappen signed up to Red Bull for the long term. Charles Leclerc's done the same at Ferrari. There's maybe an opening if Vettel walks away at the end of 2020. You know, there's a romanticism in Fernando returning to Ferrari. That would be quite fun to see. But will he go up against Leclerc? Will Leclerc be happy with that? Will Binotto want to manage that if Binotto's still in charge? And then Mercedes, well, you can't really see anyone but Lewis signing up again to be at that team. So, you know, do Toto Wolff et al. Risk another McLaren 2007 situation? It's difficult to see where he comes back. I think he's really saying, I'm available, I'm still as strong as ever, don't forget about me. But it's going to take Formula One's top teams to take that punt, I think. I don't think it's a slam dunk, but it would be exciting to see if he could make it happen.
Well, therein lies the fundamental problem, I mean, Ben, which is that Ferrari are not going to touch him with the barge pole, nor a Red Bull, nor will Mercedes, and frankly, nor will McLaren. He's just ended his relationship with them. So where's he going to come back? I can't see it happening. And this myth that somehow the field is going to close up, exactly to your point, it's not the big teams without a budget cap this year are going to be throwing huge resource, already are throwing huge resource into the new regulation. So the gap's going to open up, and I can't see he has a berth in any of the top teams available. I don't know why any of them would take him.
Flat out. But yeah, he does say in the interview that he regrets slagging off Honda, particularly the GP2 engine quote, but that kind of temperamental outburst that he's associated with has kind of tainted his stock, really, and made him someone that it's difficult to argue for as an employee. The impression he's always given is that he considers himself to be a little bit above the team, or sort of doesn't have to play the team game like that. And he says that the GP2 engine quote was a private conversation between him and his engineer, but I got the impression at the time that he knew that it would be played.
Yeah, there is a degree of playing the victim when it comes to that in the interview. You know, he regrets the publicisation of that comment, I think, rather than the fact of it. You know, because Alonso is quite a contrary to popular opinion, quite a straightforward and individual. Like he does say what he thinks. Yes, sometimes he will play, if you like, in the media and obfuscate and say things that mean something else. But you have to read between the lines. But when it comes to the fundamentals, that he's quite brutal in his honesty with his teams, and that can land him in hot water when things are publicised. But equally, he knows the game. He knows that Formula One is, you know, front and centre on TV. Broadcasting has become, you know, ubiquitous. Radio channels are open the whole time. So he's going to know that that comment is going to be heard by more people. So to then say, oh, you know, I was just chatting to my engineer, is a little bit cute. But then that said, he also makes a fair point that in the heat of the moment, when the adrenaline's pumping, drivers have outbursts, and he's not the only one. We've, you know, heard Verstappen use expletives regarding Renault live. You may feel fundamentally the same when you've calmed down, but you probably wouldn't choose to use those words or express in that same way were you, you know, sitting on the sofa or in an engineer's debrief, as you are when you're travelling at 180 miles an hour in the car.
Yeah, the emotions do run high when you're in the cockpit and you're up against it, don't they? So we sort of have to cut them a little bit of slack. On the other hand, Fernando used to actually comment about how much he appeared on TV, didn't he? You know, people would say, why is it that you're the one who's always having your radio played? And he'd say, oh, I don't know, I think they pick on me, or that sort of thing.
Yeah, he still thinks that. Yeah, he still thinks that. I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but you know, I do think the grid would be stronger for his presence. I mean, maybe that seems a bit retrograde, but I still think he's one of the top drivers out there. He certainly believes he is, and if it were possible to have him in the mix fighting with the likes of Lewis, Leclerc, Verstappen et al, that would be, you know, we've be great to see.
Shall we move from one person who's very good at publicising themselves to another? Because our other big interview this month is with McLaren CEO Zak Brown, and it was, shall we say, full of interesting details. Because I personally knew he was a Wheeler dealer, but I didn't know he funded his karting by pawning a load of watches he'd won on Wheel of Fortune. I'd love to see how he tackled Jeopardy. And then later he ended up sleeping on an air mattress on Richard Dean's floor while washing Jim Russell Racing School cars at Donington for £75 a day. So he's someone who's not, he's no stranger to hardship. So that's quite an interesting story, isn't it? Is that the strangest start to a team principal's career? Or do we know any more? Mark's probably met a few
oddball team principals. Yeah.
Well, I worked for Eddie Jordan, for goodness sake. So, I mean, I don't even have to go beyond Eddie and the start that he had. I'm trying to think which year it was, 1999 at the Spanish Grand Prix. I met a guy who was actually the boss of the Bank of Ireland, and he was at a MasterCard dinner. MasterCard were a sponsor of Jordan at the time. And this guy was sitting beside me, and he said, if you had told me 30 years ago that I'd be sitting at a VIP dinner in Barcelona with guest of honor, Eddie Jordan, coming up to say a few words, he said, I wouldn't have believed you. And I said, why? And he said, well, I sacked Eddie from the Bank of Ireland. and I said, well, why did you do that? And he said, well, he was a bank teller. He was he used to sit behind the counter at one of our branches of a bank. And he said, after a while, we began to notice that this bank seemed to be issuing a huge number of loans for secondhand cars. And when we looked into the paperwork, we discovered that Eddie was allowing customers to come straight to him. He would give them a loan to buy a car, and then he would go down after work to his second-hand car dealership and sell them the cars that he had just given them a loan for. And so this anomaly was picked up by the bank, and it was a pretty short conversation with Eddie, but meanwhile it was helping to fund his Formula Atlantic racing in Ireland. And so that was his start. Although that wasn't the weirdest thing he did. I think the weirdest thing he did was to sell rugs at the side of the Dublin to Belfast road for a while, and I've actually met people who were customers of his at his roadside rug stand, and there are to be no jokes about rugs. Stuart Codling.
Connors is definitely on the grass, I would say, listeners. He may strike the barriers at any moment.
I had a lovely chat with Johnny Herbert about Eddie's syrup at the Autosport show.
It's just appalling. I knew this is exactly where it would go as soon as I mentioned rugs, Eddie, and selling, but there we go.
Johnny was on a private jet or something with him, and Eddie was asleep, and he thought, you know, I've heard about this rug. I actually want to see it because it's, you know, it looks so realistic. So he was trying to peel it off his head while he was asleep.
Did he succeed?
Well, yeah, but it's fantastically stuck down. I've seen Eddie jump into a swimming pool before and been, you know, because you expect some sort of hairy beast to be found floating.
But look, so I'm going to say something in Eddie's defence. He suffered alopecia as a result of a very serious racing accident at Thruxton, and
I was going to ask about that because that springs to my mind too.
Exactly, very serious accident. It broke both his legs, and it's actually one of the few conversations I ever had with him about, I think, what a lot of people, if it were them, would regard as almost a kind of disability. I mean, to lose all your hair. Our hair is so important to us. I don't have much left myself, but, you know, our hair is important to all of us in terms of how we look and come across. And I think for him as a 21, 22-year-old, I mean, I remember him saying to me that, you know, his mother basically went and bought a wig because of the alopecia that he was suffering from, and how much of a mistake that was, because he said once you put it on, it becomes almost, you know, impossible to live without it. But, you know, so actually I have to say, over the time that I worked with him, I began to realize that whilst it could be a figure of fun, there was a much deeper story to that. And I think it actually is one of the backgrounds to his personality. And it's one of the reasons he's so sort of outgoing and flamboyant. It's almost a kind of, it's almost a way of coping with something which, you know, could make you want to shy away. He's gone the opposite direction.
You've made me feel guilty now for mocking the
afflicted. Thank you very much.
Shall we go move back to let's move back to Zac Brown. What do you think motivates people like this? Because for me, one of the interesting nuances of the interview was that he comes across as being excited by the deal making and the ducking and diving rather than the actual making money, because he sold his PR marketing company to Sebastian Coe's huge agency, CSM, and presumably never had to work again. But he then walked away because he felt that he had to go back to racing.
I mean, what comes across for me from the interview, and I don't know, you know, Ben, what you think, but reading it, I thought, first of all, here we have a team boss who fundamentally is a fan. I mean, he became a fan of motor racing and then fell in love in America, even though he was in the west coast of America, fell in love with Formula One, has done whatever he's had to do to come up, and actually found a little, there is a little bit of a link with Eddie Jordan we were talking about a few minutes ago. What these people have in common is they start off as racing drivers and then discover they're not quite good enough, but they are brilliant at selling. And so Zach began to play to that, and that passion he has for racing and then his ability to sell the sport that he loves has ultimately built his career in sports marketing, as you say, selling his company JMI to the Chime Group for, what's it, £74 million, so not a small deal. But really establishing himself as an excellent deal maker to the point where the shareholders of McLaren Group said, there is the guy who's going to lead the charge on McLaren's racing going forward in Formula One. And lead the charge he has, because if you compare the McLaren today in terms of sponsorship and deals and partnerships with what it was when Zach came in, I mean, he has delivered, absolutely. And that delivery commercially is what's ultimately helping them to then relax and focus on getting the competitiveness back in the team under Andrea Seidel. So I read the story as a classic, you know, racing entrepreneur who's just a damn good deal maker, and it's no surprising, not really surprising, that he's risen to the top in the way that he has.
Yeah, there's a bit of a theme in Formula One at the moment of ex-drivers who didn't quite make the grade as drivers doing very well and flourishing in senior team leadership positions in Formula One teams, isn't there? You know, Zach joins Toto Wolff, who did Formula Ford, I think, with Franz Tost in his youth.
Yeah,
Christian
yeah.
Horner, who Zach claims he's quicker than, but our subs beg to differ on closer analysis.
A little bit of self-mythologising going on there, I think.
They obviously have, you know, they get Eddie Jordan, obviously another example, as we talked about earlier. You know, they get bitten by the bug, don't they? And all racing drivers are competitive animals and good at coming back from disappointments, crave success. And if you get denied it in one path, you find another way to channel that energy. And I get the sense that Zach also has a bit of the Toto about him in terms of approach. Okay, their skill sets are probably different, but reading what Zach says, he's clearly realised that the organisation is about more than him. You know, he's not necessarily egotistical in his position at the top. He's not trying to make McLaren or mould McLaren in his image. He's trying to make sure that he can structure it and put the right people in place so that it can flourish alongside him or with him. And it's almost like he's read the Toto manual and gone, right, well, you know, I need this guy to lead the team from the engineering standpoint. I need this guy to lead the team from the racing standpoint. He's not going to do it all. Even though racing drivers can be quite selfish creatures in their racing careers, I think they kind of learn the lesson over time that it's very much a team sport and it's about other people and also being surrounding yourself with people who are better than you and who understand things better than you can. And that's where I think, you know, the strong leadership really, really bears out.
Yeah, because McLaren's had gone through quite a few changes since Zach came on board. And I remember when he hired Gilles de Farran as the sporting director or whatever, we all just kind of rolled our eyes and said, oh, he's just hiring his mates. It reads like empire building. And then Gilles de Farran's sort of almost taken himself out of the equation, hasn't he? He's gone off to do the IndyCar thing. He's got his Extreme E thing. And Andreas Seidel's been hired and seems to be the right man for the job there, doesn't he? He seems to be very, very competent. And like you say, probably better at running a race team than Zach could be.
Yeah, exactly. I think, you know, it's probably now, in retrospect, part of a bigger play, wasn't it? You know, get your mates, if you want to call it that, in at the start to help you understand an organisation that is going to be far bigger than you can cover yourself, and then work out what you need. And, you know, they say in management the ideal thing is to make yourself redundant, isn't it? So I'm not saying Zach's done that yet, but you know, maybe he's on course.
No.
He talks about the percentages of involvement of a leader in running a business. You know, when it's a smaller company, you can be in control of everything. When it's a medium-sized company, you have to let people crack on with it. When it's a really big company, such as he's got at McLaren with over 1,000 people, there's a limit to what he can do. And I think finding his feet in the early days of running that Formula One team by having a few let's not call them mates, but people he could trust around him to maybe go and fact find and say, oh my God, this bit looks awful and that bit looks like, you know, there's a bit of politics going on or whatever, you know, getting the feedback on those early stages, I think was very important to him. And so we saw sort of restructure and then restructure and then restructure as he tried to find the formula that was going to work for the team and also for him as the leader so that it could make the necessary steps. I think the surprising thing has been how quickly it has actually unfolded in a positive way. And I mean, we were talking about Fernando just a short time ago, to go from the debacle that was McLaren, Honda and Alonso to the much happier times we've seen in 2019 with drivers that get along with each other and deliver, with a customer engine partner. And of course, I'm bringing Andreas Seidel in, who's identified the need to get a proper wind tunnel up and running and then go off and do the Mercedes-Benz deal. And, you know, the trajectory that Zach has enabled to happen has been actually done in quite short order. So finding his feet was definitely something he needed to do. And I think that's what all the restructuring was about. And I think undoubtedly people like Gilles de Ferran probably did really help him to understand the whys and wherefores of the problem at McLaren before he could put some solutions in place.
It is amazing that sort of momentum they seem to have developed. And when you look at some of the other teams that they've been kind of not even neck and neck with, you know, the teams they've actually vaulted past, including their own works, the works team with their own engine supplier, which has been having a bit of a nightmare recently. So I suppose maybe we should turn to Renault, because we've got an exclusive little look at Esteban Ocon's sort of first day back in the Abu Dhabi test in this issue. And that's sort of an interesting story, because he was on that team's driver development program when they were racing as Lotus, got dropped when they ran out of money, and then he was rescued by Mercedes, who then ultimately didn't have a place for him. So that's another little interesting subtext for this season's competition, as he almost reinvents himself, I suppose, doesn't he? With Esteban Ocon at Renault, does he now look to prove himself ahead of the next Mercedes opportunity, or is it going to be kind of like a Daniel Ricciardo thing where he starts to actually cut his ties with the people that made him?
It's an each way bet at the moment, isn't it? Because I think the deal keeps Ocon at Renault. He can't be recalled until after 2022. I think that's the earliest. So he's got a separate deal with Renault, but he's also still managed by Toto Wolff, so he has ties with Mercedes. He should have, let's not forget, really been in that car a year earlier. Toto thought he had a deal with Cyril to put Ocon in that Renault seat for 2018.
Turned out it was a bit of bull.
And then Ricciardo came onto the market, and yeah, things changed. And I didn't see a deal happening, because I mean, Toto even went on record in a press conference saying that, you know, Abitur had to prove that he was a gentleman, because they'd had a gentleman's agreement and it had been broken. So they obviously managed to reconcile. And I think in fairness to Toto, he's recognised that he cannot facilitate the next stage of Ocon's career without letting him fly the nest. You know, there isn't space at Mercedes. They had the chance to put him in instead of Valtteri, decided continuity was the best option. And they don't have the sway in their customer teams to find a seat for him there. You know, George Russell's in occupancy at Williams, and Stroll's got his own plans with Racing Point, involving obviously his own son, and a long-term deal for Sergio Perez. So this is really the only way that Ocon can kind of take the next step. He needed to be in that kind of works team environment. He did a, you know, fine job in a midfield team in 2017, 2018, and he needs to be in that big team environment, I think, to develop and see if he can cut it at the top level. So it's the right step for him, and a good move for Mercedes as well, because they keep one of their own drivers. They keep ties to one of their own drivers and keep him in the mix and still growing.
It's going to be really interesting to see how Ocon and Ricciardo get alongside each other, because the you get the impression that although Nico Hülkenberg was a very rapid driver, I think Ocon's level of motivation and the phase of his career that he's in and everything that he's been through, he's going to come out fighting very hard to achieve dominance within the team, which is something Daniel Ricciardo will want to avoid happening. So they're going to push each other very, very hard indeed. One would hope they'll push each other very constructively and that it won't descend into sort of acrimony, as you know, we saw that a little bit with Ocon previously with teammates. But the reality is that they'll push each other massively. And it's going to be quite an interesting time for Renault as a team, because from a driver perspective, they've got two cracking talents now, so there could be no excuses. And the team, if it can give them a good car, will get the results. And if it doesn't get the results, it'll be because they haven't given them a quick enough car, and that will raise further questions about where Enstone are at.
It seemed like technically they were in slight disarray, and they've had the latest in what's turned out to be a long series of reorganisations over the winter, even, haven't they, with Pat Fry coming back to an as yet undefined role, Nick Chester leaving. We suspect we'll end up in the technical director's seat at Williams. So you kind of think, where does that leave them in 2020? Obviously, Pat Fry's not going to be able to influence the car they're bringing to the table this season. So are we going to see another year where they say, well, you know, we're bedding in a new technical structure? It's the dreaded I word, isn't it? The interim season.
Well, inevitably, to use another I word, because, as you say, it's too late in the day. Obviously, there's the big rule change around the corner with 2021 as well, and you need to kind of get your ducks in a row for that. So that's what the restructure will be about. 2020 will be about managing the glide path towards that as best as possible. And Ocon is kind of, I guess, the public sticking plaster, if you like, for the project, because, you know, he's an exciting driver. He's a French driver. You know, it's a French team. So that's a nice story for them to get through 2020 with. It does have the potential, I think, as Mark pointed out, to kind of blow up in their face, because Ocon is going to be young, hungry. He's hard character. He's going to be pushing extremely hard to make that team his own if he can. And you have to throw into the mix Ricciardo's situation. Now, he signed a two-year deal with that team that will run out at the end of 2020. People are already linking him with Sebastian Vettel's Ferrari seat, which comes on the market at the same time. Will Ricciardo have half an eye on that big break that he thought was maybe closed off and might come back around? That's no disrespect to Renault, but they're not at the level where they're going to be instantly in the mix with Mercedes, Ferrari, Red Bull in 2021, even if the rule changes help them and they do a good job. So there's an opportunity there for Ocon, isn't there? You know, if Ricciardo does end up being prized away because he's available, then Ocon can make that team all about him, which would be potentially really good for him at the phase of his career, regardless of how really well Renault meet the challenges of 2021.
A tough year for Renault off track, because we're going to see the outcome of the interim CEO's review of all of Renault Group's activities from a business perspective. Perhaps some pressure on Cyril Abitbol to either really deliver in Formula One in short order, or there will be a question mark over Renault's future. And there is the thing that I suspect could play into another kind of dramatic mix-up within Formula One, including perhaps enabling Ocon to break away from Renault, because there's no question if the team were to be put up for sale and sold, the Toto Wolff would probably be able to grab him back if that fitted in with Mercedes' plans. So I think for all the talk about Ocon and Ricciardo, and let's see whether the team's latest transitional year turns into a good performances for them, I think the off-track examination of Renault Group's finances, where the money's being spent, whether the Formula One team is delivering value for money, I think that's going to be a very interesting sort of developing story in the next few months.
Yeah, it's not the sort of spotlight you want on you when you're struggling to kind of get some momentum. Like we sort of saw last year the risks associated with almost taking your position within Formula One for granted. Renault had sort of reached that coveted fourth spot, best of the rest. They then said the mission statement was to consolidate that and get nearer to the top three. And the subtext of that was they were assuming that they would retain that fourth spot. And we saw actually that's quite a difficult position to attain, and arguably maybe they only achieved that fourth spot because of the problems that afflicted Racing Point during the 2018 season, because
and McLaren
as well. So yeah, it's been sort of tough going for them, and maybe they probably did. I just say maybe they probably. Within that nest of caveats, there is definitely maybe probably something to be said for not really taking things for granted in Formula One. Now, shall we, having mentioned Racing Point, there delve a little bit further into that? Mark column this month, Racing Point, Lawrence Stroll's plans for it, and a possible acquisition of Aston Martin as well. Now, obviously, Lawrence is fantastically, mouth-wateringly wealthy, and there's nothing to say he can't afford Aston Martin. There's also the fascinating nuance in your column, Mark, that at Gallagher Towers somewhere, there's a floppy disk with the commercial presentation to Tommy Hilfiger on it back in the days of commerce. And while we were sort of processing that, at the subbing stage, we were wondering whether the younger readers needed to be told what a 3.5-inch floppy was.
Surely they can work it out for themselves.
Well,
I was
about to say that my son found that my 3.5-inch floppy in the garage.
You should take better care of it.
This is like those famously missing Top of the Pops episodes that you can never watch anymore.
he asked me what it was, so I had to explain to him. And
you had to have the conversation, didn't you, Mark?
The conversation. And
Mark's now on the grass and heading for the barriers.
This is a colossal shunt. Double wave yellows.
No, he's gone. He's
safety
gone.
Car deployed.
I think this might be a DNF.
All four corners are off the car. All four corners are off the car. Anyway, yes. So let's just reverse back up a bit. So can we talk about Lawrence Stroll and Racing Point with the Aston Martin story, which was kind of the lead in to my column. So just a little couple of facts. So when Aston Martin floated on the London Stock Exchange on the 31st of October 2018, the shares were sold for £19 each. So, and the stock market, for reasons I won't bore you with, prices everything in pence. So it was 1,900 pence that the stocks were floated at. So at the time that this podcast being recorded, those shares are worth 418 pence. So we've seen a 78% catastrophic destruction of value in Aston Martin shares in a little over a year and 3 months. And this is why the company's partly one of the reasons that's showing how much trouble the company is in, because actually they had a disastrous 2019 in terms of sales. Now, I'm not a car journalist, but I read what some of the car journalists have to say about some of the new product lines that Aston Martin brought out. There's been some criticism from people about their design treatment. Maybe not the buyers don't quite like the new Vantage as much as people thought they would do at Aston Martin, all these kinds of things. So Aston Martin, in a bit of bother, Chief Executive Andy Palmer having to mount a pretty robust defence of his leadership of the company in this post-flotation era, and admitting that they're having to have talks with investors about getting a decent injection of funds. And this is where Lawrence Stroll's name has come up, not once or twice or three times. I mean, it's actually been mentioned constantly now for the last 2 months, and things have been pretty quiet since Christmas and New Year, which means really one thing, and that is that there are detailed discussions and negotiations going on. Because if those discussions and negotiations were over, you can be sure people would have said something about it. So that hasn't happened. And the interesting twist to the Lawrence Stroll, Aston Martin, Racing Point sort of thought process, you know, in which obviously includes the fact that if Lawrence Stroll buys a decent chunk of Aston Martin, there's the potential for him to rebrand the Formula One team as the Aston Martin Formula One team. And sort of a twist to that has been some stories emanating from a couple of sources that actually there's another conversation going on about Aston Martin with Toto Wolff in the event that Mercedes-Benz were to pull out of Formula One. Now, I just don't see that happening. So I think we're back to the Lawrence Stroll, Aston Martin, Racing Point discussion. And the next few weeks are going to be really interesting because the negotiations can't roll on for too much longer. Aston Martin are going to need that injection of funding, and they're going to need the certainty, and the shareholders are going to need some certainty going forward. So, you know, I think by the early part of the spring, we should be seeing, you know, some signs of whether this deal has come off. And if it does work in Racing Point's favour, I think my point in the column really is It would be utterly transformational for the Silverstone base team.
In terms of the nuts and bolts of how it might work, how would that money arrive into Aston Martin from the coffers of Lawrence Stroll? Would it be him buying shares? Would it be just, you know, suitcases full of gold, bullion turning up, for that sort of thing?
Well, Lawrence Stroll has a Hong Kong-based business partner with whom he has conducted a number of major deals over the years. They go out and they raise the funding necessary to acquire businesses. Of course, they're cash rich themselves, multi-billionaires, both of them. But going to the markets, raising funding, pulling together deals, which enables them to buy a decent enough chunk of the company that you gain, if not complete control, then enough control that you can start to call shots and really develop strategy. Now, they did that with Tommy Hilfiger, which everyone knows is a clothing company. Then subsequently then did that with Michael Kors. And of course, that built that into a phenomenal fashion brand as well. And in the case of Tommy Hilfiger and Michael Kors, you know, Tommy Hilfiger, the man, and Michael Kors, the man, they welcomed the investment that people like Lawrence Stroll were able to put into their business and to develop the brand. And that's what Aston Martin could really benefit from, their expertise in saying, what have we got that's good and that works and needs more money? And what have we got that's bad that we need to move away from? There's been news, for example, recently that Aston Martin had to cancel their electric sports car program. And that seems completely counterintuitive at the current time, you know, when the whole world's going electric and Aston Martin's not going electric. And, you know, you have to look at what Porsche are doing in that arena. And, you know, you have to think to yourself, really, can Aston Martin in 2020 do anything other than go where, you know, the whole industry is kind of being dictated to by consumers, by governments, by emissions regulations? And that all requires investment. So I think, as I say, Lawrence Stroll will have the money between his own resources and the access to funding that he unquestionably has in the markets. And then it'll just be a question of this negotiation of how much of the company is he going to get for the money that he's prepared to put in. And if his reputation is anything, you can be sure those negotiations will be incredibly tough, very brutal, and ultimately, if he gets a deal, it'll be a deal absolutely on his terms.
$1 million question I want to ask before we let you go to bed, Mark, is what was on that 3.5-inch floppy?
So I actually need to go, and you can actually buy 3.5-inch floppies to plug into your Mac or whatever and get software to decode what's on them, because I really need to go and do that, because I have a bunch of these 3.5-inch floppies in my garage. This all precedes when anyone ever thought about data protection, I hasten to add. It was never even in our employment contracts back then. So I have all kinds of proposals going back to the late 1980s. But that particular proposal I remember very well, because Eddie Jordan had, of course, sold Eddie Irvine into Ferrari. So effectively had moved him from Jordan to Ferrari, secured quite a lot of funding into Jordan Grand Prix as a result of that deal, and maintained, obviously, a very close relationship with Ferrari whilst Irvine was there. And Tommy Hilfiger was a sponsor of Ferrari, so you can imagine Eddie got to know Lawrence and came straight into the office one day and said, you know, we need to tell Tommy Hilfiger that instead of sponsoring the wing mirrors of the Ferrari, they could have the whole goddamn side pod of the Jordan and the engine cover and, you know, probably my underpants as well. So the reality is, so that's what we did. So we put together a proposal, sent it off to Lawrence Stroll to get Tommy Hilfiger on board. And I have to say, I'm not sure I don't think it even elicited a response from him. I think he may have just mentioned to Eddie, thanks for the offer, but no thanks. So it was
he wasn't impressed by your floppy.
He wasn't impressed by that 3.5-inch floppy, no.
At least you tried.
It forced me to say thank you very much for your time, Mark Gallagher. Thank you very much, Ben Anderson.
You're welcome.
F1 Racing is on the newsstands now. Visit f1racing.com for the latest subscription deals, and we'll be back next month with the first edition of Grand Prix Racing magazine. In the interim, don't forget to check out the Autosport podcast and our many other offerings.